This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The White House's budget proposal has set alarm bells jangling for social service providers. How will budget cuts affect food assistance programs? Food banks like Second Harvest of Central Florida get a portion of their funding from the government. But what really worries Dave Krepko is a plan to trim more than $190 billion from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, better known as food stamps, over a decade. Well, Dave Krepko is the CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Good to be here.
So tell me how much of what you do depends on federal funding, and how does that work? Is it direct funding or through the local government?
Well, on federal funding, we receive some stuff that flows through the state. You know, every state is allocated a certain percentage. But, you know, our annual budget, about 14% is government funded. The impact isn't necessarily on us as an organization if budgets are cut. You know, the real impact is on, you know, the partner feeding programs that we work with and the clients that they serve.
That would put more pressure on you guys in turn?
Oh, yeah. With the proposed budget cuts of the current administration that came out last week, it would put incredible pressure on the food bank and our network of 550 feeding programs in Central Florida, because the budget calls for a $193 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar cut over 10 years to SNAP, which is food stamps, and that's nationally. Plus, it would require states to pay up to 25% of those benefits. So on top of the cuts, you know, for Florida, that would mean another $1.3 billion that they would be expected to pay. And, you know, we know that kind of support is probably not going to happen. But when you look at the reduction, the potential reduction in the number of meals as a result, it's just phenomenal. It's hundreds of thousands of fewer meals, upwards of a half a million annually.
And is that from your point of view, from what the Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida does as far as meals? Can you put a number on that, like what this reduction, what kind of impact that would have on the number of meals you are able to serve?
Well, in terms of just the cuts to SNAP, you know, it could be as easily as high as a half a million meals just for Central Florida a year. For us here at Second Harvest Food Bank, the cutback in funding, it's really hard to calculate at this point what they would do in terms of what you call administrative funding. For us, you know, as an organization, it may not amount to a lot, okay? Our deep, deep concern is, you know, the end result of these cuts to the population that we're serving.
What about the local funding picture or the statewide funding picture? Like, if this big federal funding cut does come to pass, or even if it's a smaller cut but it's significant, who do you reach out to? Who can you tap for extra assistance in the state or even locally?
Boy, we would really have to go to the state legislature next year and, you know, ask for additional support. We would have to go to local charitable foundations and corporate foundations and just reach out to the community and really say, hey, listen, you know, we have lineups of people that that need our help. You know, can everybody pitch in? I don't think it should be 100% of the government's job to do it, or 100% of corporate America or private citizens. I think it's all those folks coming to the table.
Just remind me again, Dave Krepko, how many people rely on food from Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida for across the space of a year?
Yeah, over the course of a year, approximately 450,000 people, different people, rely on our network. Lots of those folks, it's multiple times they need help. When you look at the number of kids that are in need, one in four children that need food, we have a percentage that are seniors and disabled and vets that require food. And then there's a large group in between those two. They are the working poor. You know, the wages are not keeping pace with what it takes to run a household.
Which group are you most concerned about at this point?
Children, for sure. You know, when you think of one in four, and when you think of the SNAP program going back to the, you know, proposed cuts, I don't think people realize that 40% of the people who benefit from SNAP are children, because you're impacting families. So 40% of them, and not too far behind them. You know, I mentioned this group of seniors or disabled folks, vets. That's about another 25%.
And what are you hearing from those people? How concerned are they about what could happen to them if some of these cuts come to pass?
Well, the actual recipients, I mean, they're deeply concerned. You know, they're not able to balance their household budgets as it is now. And if there's cuts to SNAP, then it's going to become even tougher. You know, food is one of those things in budgets that's elastic. You know, people will make it shrink when it has to shrink, and but you know, they want to pay their rent or pay the mortgage to keep their roof over their head and not become homeless. It's just going to be put a lot more people at risk.
So the White House budget chief Mick Mulvaney describes the budget proposed by President Trump as, you know, a budget that looks at the needs of taxpayers. I mean, if there are people who are concerned about how much tax they're paying, what's your argument to them?
Well, let's look at taxpayers. The recipients are taxpayers too. You know, there's a lot of working households out there, and you pay your taxes to get certain benefits like Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare or SNAP. You know, and for taxpayers, if you're making a multi-billion-dollar cut to a program like this, that is $193 billion less dollars in our local economies. You know, that creates jobs. It helps the retail food industry. It helps agriculture. And here we are in an agricultural state, one of the finest there is in the country. So it has huge economic impact. And then, you know, when people aren't getting proper nutrition, you know, you're going to see a number of healthcare issues, you know, continue or get exacerbated because it costs money to eat fairly healthy. And what happens is when people don't have the money, they're going to rely on the cheap foods, which are the high starch, high caloric kind of thing. And then you're talking about folks with type 2 diabetes, hypertension. And when that happens, you know, the whole community suffers because healthcare costs start going through the roof. You know, the nutritional needs of these folks just aren't being met as it is.
So what do you do now? You get more involved in lobbying at the state level. You reach out to the federal government. What's your game plan to try and turn this around if you can?
Right. We're working in conjunction with an organization called Feeding America. We're one of 200 members across the United States, and we're working closely with them, with their Washington office. They have good relationships with people up on the Hill, and what we are doing is collecting our 200 voices from around the country on, you know, what the impact is going to be at the grassroots level, and collecting our voices at that national level, where Feeding America can advocate on behalf of the, you know, protecting the funding for these programs. Part of our game plan here, break that down a little bit. You know, we want to gather the voices of our 550 partner feeding programs around this too, so senators and representatives can hear directly from them on, hey, this is the impact that's going to happen, and, you know, please protect this funding.
Now, people have seen the Second Harvest Food Bank's distribution center. It gives you a sense of the scale of the need for food in this community. I'm wondering, do you feel like this needs somebody from the administration, whether it's somebody at a low level or whether it's the president himself, to come down and take a look and see what's going on to get a sense of what the issue is and how to move forward with it?
I think a visit like that would be really good. You know, some of our some of our local representatives and one of our senators have visited the food bank to get a closer look so they can get an understanding of the impact and to talk to people who are on the receiving end of this food. There's nothing like sitting down for just a couple of minutes and hearing these folks' stories, because there's just so many stereotypes that are held out there that are from, you know, years and years ago, and times have changed dramatically. You know, we're pulled out of the Great Recession, but poverty levels are still higher right now than at the beginning of the before the recession started, you know. So the recession has a long tail on it, and yeah, these elected officials, they have to get closer to the people to hear their stories and why the people are in these predicaments.
Do you feel, Dave Kripko, like your job is changing? Is your role now more of a lobbying role to try and get more attention or more funding towards ending hunger, or even just sort of maintaining what you're doing now?
Well, definitely part of my role is to advocate in an even stronger way, because of the proposals that are being made. We see a great need that's about to arise. We're not filling the gap on food as it is right now. So, yeah, a role of mine is to definitely advocate more on behalf of these folks, and that's to get more of the community engaged.
Okay, so what does the next couple months look like for you? Both for yourself and also for the folks who are working there at the food bank and further out.
You know, our main focus that's cranking up right now is to focus on summer feeding and summer feeding of children. It's the most critical time of the year because they're out of school. They don't have that school lunch or school breakfast. So we are busy providing about 8,000 meals a day to about 91 sites around Central Florida. The other thing we're doing, from an advocacy point of view, is that this August, there's a summer recess for our nationally elected officials where they come back to their homes, their districts. And we are putting together a plan to do a lot of outreach to those elected officials when they come back to show them the data, on, hey, here's what's proposed, here's the impact on the economy and people in your district, in your area, in your state, and even set up a couple of conversations with people that are on the receiving end. You know, when they can sit down and look at a senior citizen that's trying to hold down a job, has worked their whole life, can't make it on, Social Security, and they don't have other family support. I mean, people like that are in just really, really tough situations.
Dave Kripko, how worried are you about what could happen with this budget?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, right now I'm at a 9, And we like to think that we're the eternal optimists around here doing this work. We're always looking for the bright spot. But I am deeply concerned about the direction that this is going.
Do you think that folks in the administration can be talked around on this?
I want to remain hopeful that folks in the administration will come to terms with this, and hopefully these cuts will not occur. It's a proposed budget. We know that the president has proposed a few other things that have not gone through Congress. So we're at the early stages of this, and it's going to be just critical to educate and inform our elected officials at the grassroots level first. And as these conversations continue in Washington, that better minds will prevail over this.
Well, Dave Kripko is the CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, do Florida lawmakers still have time to roll out a plan for medical marijuana?
I think they'll bring it up in special session. I think, being that it's a constitutional amendment, it's so popular, dispensaries. The first one opened in Orlando just recently, so I think we're well down the road.
And is there a wild card Republican waiting in the wings in the race for governor?
He was Richard Nixon's dirty trickster, and he worked neck and neck with Donald Trump to get him elected. This guy has got some personal net worth. He's got a network.
Find out who when we come back. You can take Intersection with you, download the WMFE app, or you can listen to the podcast. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Medical marijuana, education, and funding programs to lure businesses and tourists to the Sunshine State. These were some of the sticking points for lawmakers and Governor Rick Scott in a contentious legislative session. Lawmakers are back tomorrow for a special session to tie up loose ends. And for more on what that session holds, we're joined by Republican analyst Michelle Ertel. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Hello.
And former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchelor. Thank you, Dick.
Good morning.
So, the special session, a deal was reached. Things are dragged out there for some time, but lawmakers and the governor are going to get back together and talk it out this week. What's in store for that special session?
Well, it's very fascinating. It was an $83 billion budget passed. The governor vetoed about $11 billion of that. Most of that was K-12 education and said, look, you're going to come back and going to give us more. We want, instead of $24 per student increase, we want $100, which is about a $400 million deal probably, or more. So that got resolved, which is interesting. And then what I think fascinating, I think that the ongoing fight between Richard Corcoran, the Speaker of the House, and the governor over funding for Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida. It looks like he's going to get his funding for Visit Florida. And not for Enterprise Florida, but a new entity that he's obviously created. He wants about $86 million for not front-end incentives, but incentives for infrastructure and hiring people. So it looks like the governor actually thinking winning in this session.
What do you make of the way that all played out, Michelle? Because as Dick pointed out, there was some arguing beforehand on the future of Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida. We saw that tour of the state by the governor trying to drum up support for his causes. Looks like, as Dick said, he won that round.
Well, it was bloody. He did and he didn't. Richard Corcoran, House Speaker Richard Corcoran, is a fiscal conservative, and he vowed to get rid of corporate welfare. So when they started this new program to replace EFI, it's called the Florida Job Growth Grant Fund. And as Dick said, it's jobs and infrastructure, but it's not going to give corporate welfare to one particular entity.
So is it just Enterprise Florida by a different name?
No. It's not, because, you know, Enterprise Florida, that was corporate welfare, if you ask anybody. But this is not that. Because they're not going to be able to give it to one particular entity. It's going to be able to go to other entities, and there's going to really be accountability through this. So it's going to be really good. And I think that I wouldn't say that the governor won, but I would say that it's a draw here.
Michelle, education was kind of another choke point, if you will, for the legislators and the governor. What happens from here on out?
Well, this week is going to be interesting when they are in session. It's a special session, and I think a lot of this is going to come down to education. You know, there's $413 million at stake. And much of that is teacher bonuses. So it doesn't really affect charter schools, but it will affect public schools. And I think there's going to be some give and take and some serious negotiation so that everybody's happy. Teachers unions want one thing. The governor and the Republicans want another thing. And I think we're just going to have to see how it all shakes out.
Dick Batchelor, there have been calls from teachers unions and other groups invested in public education to veto the entire education bill for various reasons. What do you see happening?
Probably because it's Speaker Corcoran's number one priority, because he's got a lot of charter schools, about $400 million in charter school monies in there, and he wants that very desperately. You're right, the Florida Education Association, the Superintendents Association, the School Boards Association, everybody's asked the governor to veto that piece of legislation. And their contention is, even with the increase in what they call FEFP funding, even with the increase per student for K-12 education, even with that, they're thinking the giveaway to charter schools, because the law changes and the monies that local schools raise through ad valorem taxes can now be used under this law to fund charter schools construction, which mm-hmm. is unprecedented. So it's a very contentious. But if I were to guess, I would guess the governor's not going to veto that. He'll just be satisfied to get his $100 per student.
So just to backtrack a little bit, so what you're saying, Dick Batcher, is that, for example, if there's a sales tax for a school district, mm-hmm. then some of that money could be, instead of going to the traditional public schools, it could be used to build
absolutely
public charter schools.
And Speaker Corcoran, and that piece of legislation has another piece of legislation, which is basically to create, basically to allow charter schools to go into low-income neighborhoods, have low-performing schools, and open a charter school to basically supplant that public school. It's very mm-hmm. controversial, but I still think it's going to be passed.
All right, medical marijuana. What happens for this amendment? Because lawmakers couldn't decide how to implement this. Dick Batchelor, is there room in the special session? Is there time in the special session to figure that out?
I think so. Keep in mind, the constitutional amendment passed by 76% of the vote, so it's a very popular constitutional amendment, number one. Number two, the legislature... the Republican leadership have over the last few years tried to work on medical marijuana, but they could not reach an agreement. The Senate, for instance, had a bill that would allow to grow more plants. You would have 12 nurseries instead of five dispensaries per nursery. But the House could not agree on that. But I think they'll bring it up in special session. I think, being that it's a constitutional amendment, it's so popular. The dispensary is the first one opened in Orlando just recently, so I think we're well down the road. I hope the legislature will reach a resolution on that during the special session.
But truthfully, if they don't, it's okay, because the Department of Health right. is working on that. So right. This is going to get implemented, and implemented soon, whether it be by the legislature or by the Department of Health. When I spoke to a member of the House last night, he told me that they could very well wake up this morning with implementation rules. And so I think we just need to sit back and wait. But it's going to get worked out. I feel very confident that when the next month or so, maybe 2 months, we'll know exactly what it's going to be.
I think the John Morgans of the world and the ones that support the Constitutional Amendment really would hope the legislature would do, because it appears mm-hmm. the legislature is being, I hate to use this word and scare them away, but a little bit more liberal than the Department of Health is as support when it comes to the number of dispensaries.
Dick Batchelor, on that note, I mean, is it okay for the Department of Health, I mean, from the point of view of people who voted for this amendment, to see the Department of Health decide how it's going to be rolled out, or are folks on the side of the amendment saying, look, we're worried there's going to be too much red tape tied up in this?
Well, traditionally, as the Constitutional Amendment passes, then the legislature passes the implementing legislation. So I would hope, and I think the public would hope, that the legislature would handle this and not defer it to the Department of Health.
Michelle Otello, we spoke to Barbara Peterson on this program a little while back about the issue of transparency, and they were sort of unlikely allies at that point, the First Amendment Foundation and the governor, saying, look, things weren't really done out in the open here. This is why some of this legislation should be vetoed. Just kind of give us the long view here. I mean, has the governor changed his stance a little bit on government in the sunshine in his tenure as governor?
Well, I think he has become more open. You know, when you're in business like he was for all of those years, you didn't have to deal with the media. So I think as he has become more familiar with the media and has had to work with the media and use the media to get his message out, mm-hmm. he has begun to understand the importance of free speech and government in the sunshine. So, yes, I do think that he has become more comfortable with it. And I kind of think that as he goes forward to run for another seat, he's going to be loving it even more, because he's going to need the media to do that. So.
Quick point, I agree with you, is to keep in mind the first time he ran for governor, he refused to meet with any editorial boards to seek their endorsement. But he's come a long way. And there is a thing in the background of the thing, U.S. Senate, U.S. Senate, U.S. Senate. I need a better relationship with the media.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, speaking of races for higher office, let's take a look at the governor's race. It's a fairly crowded field already. Dick Batchelor on the Democratic side. Who stands out from that pack?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, the Democratic side, Gwen Graham, a former congressperson who'd only served one term, but she's the daughter of Senator Bob Graham. Name recognition is worth a lot of money statewide, number one. Number two, Mr. Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee, has raised about $1 million, is an impressive candidate. But the fact is, you've got Philip Levine, the mayor of Miami Beach, who's kind of waiting in the wings, who has mm-hmm. a personal net worth of $100 million. So if Philip Levine gets in, being from the South, being a Democrat, if he gets in as a Democrat and was willing to spend that kind of money, then he could move to the head of the line.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Otello, it's not so crowded on the Republican side mm-hmm. as yet.
Well, it's going to get more crowded. I do not think for one minute that Carlos Baruff was appointed chairman of the Constitutional Revision Committee by Governor Scott if he wasn't expected to perhaps carry on his legacy, whether that is in a governor's race or a Senate race or House race. It's hard to say, but I think that we're going to look at Baruff to do something. Mm-hmm. I think that Richard Corcoran, he has been making quite a name for himself, and I wouldn't be shocked to see him get in that race or perhaps even in the Senate race to unseat Nelson. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. We're looking at Senator Jack Latvala, mm-hmm. who is a moderate, who is from down near Clearwater. Mm-hmm. He's another potential. So, and a real wild card that has been whispered about is Roger Stone, who is from Palm Beach, yep. And he is, you know, as we know, he was Richard Nixon's dirty trickster, mm-hmm. and he worked neck and neck with Donald Trump to get him elected. This guy has got some personal net worth. He's got a network, and, you know, Republican circles, his name's being thrown about. So it'll be interesting to see where that ends up.
What about Ron DeSantis? I've heard that name mentioned as well.
You know, I think that he's not going to do it. He is a very strong candidate. He is a candidate that conservatives really, really like. But I think he's going to stay put.
Mm-hmm. I think he got endorsed last week by nationally talk show host, syndicated Mark Levine. Mm-hmm. So it probably gives him a little bit of a nudge maybe to get into the race. But the Democrats, if you ask them who we're watching, it's Adam Putnam.
Right.
Secretary and the Commissioner of Agriculture. He's raised about $7 million. Got tremendous name recognition. He was like a legislator at the age of 21, congressman at the age of 25, in the Congress, moved up quick, came back to be Commissioner of Agriculture. So he's a strong, strong candidate.
I agree with you, and I think he's the one to beat right now.
Does he have bipartisan support, Dick Batchelor?
Yes, he's garnering some Democratic support. And then if I take my Democratic hat off for a minute and look at the guy, he's a very impressive guy.
What stands out?
His knowledge and his drive, and he's more of a moderate. You don't see him getting involved in the fringe issues.
Mm-hmm. And the political climate we're in, where it seems like outsiders have a better shot these days, is that a good thing, being such a political insider?
I won't pretend to tell you how Republican primaries are going to go.
I don't pretend to tell you either.
That was Republican analyst Michelle Ertel and former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchelor. Still to come, Edward Johnson says when he rides the bus, customers recognize him and they're not shy about sharing what they think could be improved. The Lynx CEO says he welcomes the dialogue.
Talking to me on the bus, that's one way, but pulling together as a group and talking about how you want to see transit expanded in this community goes a long way as well.
Building a better bus service, that's when we come back. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Edward Johnson wants to build a better bus service in Orlando. That includes dedicated bus lanes on busy roads, making sure the bus service keeps pace with a growing population, and working with commercial transportation providers like Uber to fill in the transit gaps. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Matt.
Edward, you came to this job from Atlanta, but you also spent 13 years at Lynx before that. What made you want to come back here?
Well, when I came to Orlando back in the year of 2000, I fell in love with this community. So this is now my home. I'm originally from Birmingham, Alabama, and going over to Atlanta really was an experience for me to understand how a much larger and progressive transit system operates. Mm-hmm. When I went to work in Atlanta, my family stayed here in Orlando, so I was commuting back and forth. So this is my home, and I never want to ever leave again.
So how much bigger is Atlanta's transit system compared to what we have here at Lynx?
Well, when you think about the transit agency in Atlanta, that's nearly a $1 billion operation, whereas we're closer to a total budget of about $200 million. So in size from a dollar value and investment. But we operate over 300 buses here in Orlando. In Atlanta, it was closer to 600 buses, mm-hmm. but they had four rail lines that actually navigated throughout the metropolitan area.
Including a rail line to the airport, right?
Absolutely. You had a rail line that stopped right into the airport, just a staircase down from the baggage claim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you think about what they have there in other cities and you look at Orlando, is that something you would like to see here?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's a partnership with the Orlando International Airport right now as they're building out their multimodal terminal, and we're looking to tie right into that terminal because just as the leadership, Mr. Phil Brown over at the airport wants to make the access for their customers, we want to do the same thing. So it is truly a collaborative effort and partnership between both organizations.
Mm-hmm. So you've been back at Lynx for about a year now. What works and what doesn't work at the operation?
Well, I would say, let me start with what works first. Mm-hmm. And that is the commitment to providing good quality transportation. Coming back to the Orlando area, the staff is truly committed. Our board members are more than committed, and they want to see the expansion of transit. The question becomes exactly how do we pay for it?
Right.
And that's always the tough conversation. So, but if you don't have a willingness in your heart, the other part, the hard, difficult part is coming up with the money will never come to fruition. So, but in order for us to do that, I think that I have a real responsibility of presenting to our board of directors of what transit should look like here in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about what it should be, but we need to be able to see it, you know, on paper.
What does that look
like? Yeah, well, one thing that we really have at our disposal, at our fingertips to really push forward is to start at the baseline for premium transit. And what I mean by that is bus rapid transit.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, a lot of people will identify with operating some form of rail.
Right.
But, you know, that's a very costly endeavor. So my thought is that we need to start off at the lowest level possible, providing bus rapid transit as a premium transit service where services are frequent as frequently as 10 minutes per between buses,
mm-hmm.
but also operating in its own dedicated right of way so that the buses are just whizzing down the road and while the cars are sitting stuck in traffic. That is a good motivator for people to try transit. So when you think about all the various corridors that we have here in Central Florida, you know, Highway 50, 1792, Highway 436, Highway 192, those are great corridors where we can move a lot of people and move them quickly from their homes to their final destinations.
But you got to work with the Florida Department of Transportation, and how willing are they to put in a dedicated bus lane along 50, for example?
Oh, absolutely. The Florida Department of Transportation has been a wonderful partner with Lynx over the years. We're in discussions with them in partnership with the Florida Department of Transportation as well as Osceola County government,
right,
and looking at placing bus rapid transit down in that area.
Because that's a high growth area as far as population, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things that I've learned since coming back, the openness for discussion is just wonderful. And I don't know if you can find the level of openness in other places that I have received since I've come here. Speaking with the Florida Department of Transportation, the communications that I've had with the staff at SunRail, even having the conversations with the Central Florida Expressway mm-hmm. Authority, all wonderful dialogue on how we come together to provide transportation for the citizens of Central Florida. Because every mode of transportation is not the only solution for a particular person. One solution may be good for one trip, but then there's another mode that's probably best for another. So what we want to do is partner with one another to make sure that we're encompassing the needs of our community, but we're working together to accomplish accomplish those. So the level of partnership and openness with all the organizations in the Central Florida area has been just great.
So how do you turn that talk into action? Because it takes a long time to get transportation projects actually to the finished product, right?
Yeah, you've got to do the studies to understand how each organization needs to operate and meet its objectives. So oftentimes you do run into a situation where there are competing objectives.
Sure.
But going through that study and understanding what we can do to cross those hurdles or break through those hurdles is the best way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And again, like for us, my opinion is that just having a dialogue gets us 50% through the process. Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at bus rapid transit, you talked about a couple of the routes which would be ideal for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, realistically, how far off is that? How far into the future can we expect to see a bus rapid transit line along, for example, State Road 50?
Yeah. You know, that a process like that takes anywhere between 3 to 5 years, mm-hmm. depending on the availability of funding as well as going through the proper studies. But there certainly opportunities where we can start the effort immediately by putting in limited stop bus service. So you may not have the dedicated lane right of way, but you can go ahead and start putting in the frequent bus service.
So this would be like an express bus.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to Edward Johnson. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Lynx. Let me ask then about funding, because you mentioned that is the critical part of the piece, and mm-hmm. I know you've had some experience out in Atlanta with looking at sales taxes to, mm-hmm. to get funding for mass transit. What's the appetite for that here in Orlando?
I think that the appetite is growing. The question becomes, what is the proper solution to generate those additional funds? That is the question that we have to answer, and that's where we want to bring all of our elected officials together to talk about how do we accomplish this. Remember, we're not just a single county that we operate in,
right,
like in some other states. We operate over 3 counties, but we also go into neighboring counties outside of our geographical authorized area of operation. So to bring that mass of people together and talk about what is that best solution for that community, you know, that takes a little discussion. And so we don't want to rush into this because we want to do the right thing, that the product that we put out to the people to act upon. We want them to receive that in the most positive way, and then we have a positive return from the public. So it's going to take a little while. But we're not going to say that, well, we don't have any money, so we're not going to do anything. I think it's imperative of the Lynx staff to look deep within the organization, understand how we can provide the same level or better services with the resources that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to look at how can we deliver these services differently, but yet give more to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And one way of that is rather than continue to be a one-size-fit-all organization from a bus standpoint, now there are going to be some routes where we need articulated buses,
right,
and we don't have to put additional 40-foot buses out there to deliver the service.
Mm-hmm.
Same cost for the operations, just a little bit more cost on the capital side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we recognize there are some areas that don't really require such a large vehicle as a 40-foot bus. Maybe we use smaller vehicles to deliver those services.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a savings. And then we can expand resources where there is a real or greater need.
Do you ride the bus in Orlando?
Oh, yeah, I do. I grew up riding the bus. My father was the only driver in the house. And my mother did not drive, never had a driver's license. So when my father was at work, my mother and I did all of my doctor's appointments, dentist appointments by bus. So bus was, you know, taking a bus or public transit as a whole just wasn't anything foreign to me. So, and I still ride the bus. I enjoy riding the bus and talking with our customers and talking with our employees.
What do the customers tell you?
Well, most talk about on-time performance. We recognize that as being an issue.
So do you cop a lot of flack when you get on the bus and say, look, I'm the CEO of this organization. What do you think?
Well, you know, I never mention that I'm the CEO of the organization.
Okay. Undercover boss.
Yeah. But, you know, they know. Mm-hmm. And they say, hey, we know you. And I'm pleasantly surprised that they recognize me. But they have never engaged in such a way that they were hostile. They show excitement and appreciation for the services that they do have, but have some expectations of seeing it even better.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't argue with them. I agree with them wholeheartedly. I support their enthusiasm and I invite them to get engaged. You know, talking to me on the bus, that's one way, but pulling together as a group and talking about how you want to see transit expanded in this community goes a long way as well.
What about bus stops? Because some of the bus shelters in Orlando are not great, right? I mean, it's basically a bench on the side of a highway.
Yeah. Well, when we look at our bus stops and as far as the placement of bus shelters, what we look very closely at is the number of passengers that are boarding the buses at that particular location. So there may be a stop where there's nothing there but the bus stop sign. Generally, there's not a lot of ridership there that will warrant the type of investment that will be necessary for a bus bench or even a bus shelter. So it's really driven by the utilization.
Edward Johnson, what's your pitch to drivers? Because to get the tax base you need or the funding you need to support mass transit, you're going to have to reach out to people who don't necessarily use the bus all the time, right? So what's your pitch to them?
Well, first and foremost, enhancing public transit in our community has a very, very broad impact on the community. While that particular person that's in their car may not utilize transit at all, but by them having the or providing the resources so that we can expand transit, it gives other people opportunities who will take transit, and that will help to reduce a lot of the congestion on our roadways.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask too about the rideshare part of the picture, because in some cities they are actually actively reaching out to companies like Uber, like Lyft, and saying, can you help us out? Like Altamont Springs had a pilot project to try and sort of help them sort of fit in part of the puzzle of mass transit. Like, is that a good move? Do you see some pitfalls there?
Oh, no. I think that's a wonderful solution to help us in our growing needs of transit. When we think about areas that we're not currently servicing right now, rather than placing a 40-foot bus into operations and having a guesstimate that people will ride the bus and they will come in droves isn't the most prudent way of starting new services. So we want to engage Ubers and the Lyfts and other transportation network companies to utilize their services to help grow the transit demand. Mm-hmm. And then as that demand exceeds that capacity, then we will start putting larger vehicles out. But not going out there and just saying, well, we're going to invest, you know, $750,000 to $1 million in operations and the ridership just isn't there that warrants that level of investment.
Mm-hmm. So who makes the move? Is it the city or is it Lynx?
It would be Lynx. Part of what we have entitled is our mobility management program. Mm-hmm. And that is that we're going to apply the right technology for the environment that we are wanting to operate that service. So if we need more of a sedan demand response operation, that's what we would do. And then let it grow up to be more of a mini bus that could deliver their service, then going on up to the 40 and the 60-foot bus. And we're doing the exact same thing for our paratransit. We have many customers who utilize our paratransit services who don't need the wheelchair lift-equipped vehicle.
Mm-hmm. They just need a smaller vehicle that can get there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so we are going to and we started engaging taxicab companies as well as the TNCs to help us with delivering those services.
What's a TNC?
A transportation network company.
So you're talking about Uber or Lyft?
Yes, that's right.
So you're in talks with them right now?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
How soon would you be working with them?
Well, we're thinking within the next few months, we should have a lot of this kicked off. Mm-hmm. We were waiting for the state legislature to take care of its requirements of standardizing the requirements of how Ubers and Lyfts would operate in our communities. As soon as the governor signs off on the legislation, we can really start to roll that out.
Now, one of the criticisms is transparency. Like, people want to know, you know, what kind of service Uber is providing, how many people are taking those trips, and Uber is kind of cagey about sharing that data. Yeah. Is that, do you see that as a problem?
Not for us, no. What we would do, we still want our customers to go through us to schedule the services. We would put it through our database and then push the information to the Ubers and Lyfts of the world. Mm-hmm. That way we will have our own information.
And will you be able to share that with the public as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Our information is always open to the general public.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask finally Edward Johnson about the federal funding piece. Now, in the proposed budget from the White House, there is a pretty hefty chunk taken out of transportation funding, a lot of that mass transit. Does that concern you? Is that sort of giving you, making you, keeping you up at night, so to speak?
Well, there's always concern when those types of pots of monies are being impacted. But while the president has put in his recommendation for the budget, ultimately it's Congress that sets the budget. And right now what we're hearing is that there is a lot of enthusiasm for keeping the funding of transit at the same levels that it has been in the past, if not mm-hmm. Increasing the levels of transit.
So you feel like you've got some congressional support?
Yes, absolutely. And so we're sitting patiently to understand what the final outcome is. Mm-hmm. The American Public Transportation Association is being very, very aggressive about communicating the benefits of transit, not only from the service delivery side, but from the local employment side. Because transit, you have to build those vehicles somewhere. Mm-hmm. And if you stop building those vehicles, then that has an impact on the local economy. And when you look at the bus itself, most people, they can see the outer structure, mm-hmm. but inside that bus, it is one big computer that's in so many different parts, mm-hmm. and those components are manufactured throughout the United States,
including here in Florida.
There are a couple of places where they make some of the components, mm-hmm. or they serve as distribution points, mm-hmm. here in Florida. I'm not entirely sure exactly where they are.
The big picture, it's good.
It's good for the economy across our land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One more thing I should ask you too, actually. I mean, you mentioned before connections to SunRail, and that's been one of the kind of concerns about making SunRail a viable system is getting that last mile, whether it's mm-hmm. bus, whether it's, you know, a taxi, whether it's Uber, whether it's jumping on a bike or something. How is that working from Lynx's point of view, and what can you do to make that better?
Well, right now, in order to meet the original objective of making connections to SunRail, we extended our existing fixed route to tie into SunRail. We now want to re-engineer that and focus on first mile, last mile connectivity versus trying to connect this route that's an hour long, mm-hmm. and getting caught up in the regular traffic. That's probably not the tool that would incentivize people to want to connect between Lynx to SunRail. So we're going to work very closely with SunRail to identify the appropriate first mile, last mile connectivity routes and look at how we operate that. And, mm-hmm. and I think that would be a great feeder service back into SunRail, and you will see ridership continue to rise.
Well, Edward Johnson is the CEO of Lynx. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you very much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. And our intern is Talia Blake. You can download the podcast from iTunes, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.